Welcome to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In a few minutes, white fragility, white privilege, white guilt. What do these phrases mean? And how can people of all races do better? First, our top story this hour. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan's expected to announce Seattle's next chief of police this month. The three finalists are interim Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, Minneapolis Police Inspector Eddie Frizzell, and Austin Assistant Chief of Police Eli Reyes. I spoke with them yesterday one-on-one, and you will hear from each of them now, beginning with Carmen Best. You might remember that 6 weeks ago, Best was not included on the list of three finalists for the permanent job. At the time, KUOW spoke to some community members who were unhappy about that decision, but now the former Pittsburgh police chief, Cameron McClay, has withdrawn as a finalist, and Carmen Best is back in. So I started by asking her how she feels about all of this.
I'm actually just so excited to be back in the running for the permanent police chief's job. It is what I've been training to do, wanting to do for my entire career now, and I feel very gratified to be back in the running, and I'm just going to work really hard to make it permanent.
A lot of people are asking, what happened? So what happened, Chief?
Well, you know, I got the call that one of the persons had withdrawn and asked if I would be interested in continuing forward with my name, and I absolutely was interested, and that's where we are.
We're hearing that, again, the former Pittsburgh police chief, Cameron McClay, might take a different role in the Seattle department, maybe a mayor's advisor on police reform and public safety. How would you work with someone in that role?
Yeah, none of that has been explained to me or been vetted out. And so I let the electeds deal with that. I'm just concerned right now with working and moving forward on trying to be the permanent chief in the Seattle Police Department. That is my sole intent and interest at this point.
You have been called an insider. How do you feel about that label?
Well, I came from within the ranks of the department.
Yeah.
So that is true.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of the fact that I came through the Seattle Police Department, 26 years, working really hard. I've worked in patrol and investigations and management. I've been a beat cop. I've been undercover. I've been a precinct commander. I've been a chief of investigations, filling in for the chief of police, deputy chief of police, and the interim chief of police. So I feel that it's a good thing. It's getting me a lot of experience. I know the community. I know the area. I'm a hometown girl, and I want to punch it forward and be the permanent police chief.
At the same time, that term insider was counted against you by the four chairs of the search committee. They submitted a memo to Mayor Durkan saying as much. As the reforms, the required police reforms go on, there would be consequences for people you've maybe worked with for 10 or 20 years. How do you reassure officers and the mayor that you are willing to make those reforms?
Look, I'm not new to this, right? Chief O'Toole, who is a recognized international reform leader, handpicked me to run the day-to-day operations of the Seattle Police Department 4.5 years ago to make sure that we reached our reform goals and efforts. And we were essentially full and effective compliance. Now we're at the stage where we need to work really hard to make sure that all of those reforms are embedded in the culture of the organization, that the culture is continuously improving and innovating and moving forward.
I have heard anecdotal reports about disgruntled police officers. And I did talk just on background with a police officer I know who's talking about maybe looking to leave, saying that some officers feel that they are made to be the bad guy or that they have a disincentive to do their jobs. Do you acknowledge that that's a feeling among some officers?
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's lots of different feelings amongst all the officers.
Is it a significant problem?
What I will tell you is this. You know, I'm hearing all this talk about morale and other issues, but I'm looking at the numbers and what officers are doing. Their proactivity is way up, you know, and every single week. Every week, I look at work that officers have done where they have selflessly put themselves in harm's way to protect each other, to protect the community, to do a job well done. So while there may be some frustration about not having contract, and rightfully so, there's some frustration about the staffing issues that we're going through, and rightfully so, these cops are out here every day giving 110%. And for that, you know, I'm grateful, and I would say that they're not doing the work, and they're not leaving in droves. They're here getting it done.
Not standing down.
Not standing down. Not that I've seen. And I look at this stuff all the time.
I mentioned this memo from the search committee, and there were some criticisms in there. Quote, SPD faces significant resource deployment challenges. Less than half of all sworn officers are assigned to patrol, a percentage that is inconsistent with a national practice of 60% or more of sworn officers being assigned to patrol. End of quote. Do you accept that criticism? And if so, how would you change it?
This is not true. You know, in fact, you know, 57% of our officers are assigned to patrol. And that 60% number is not a national. You can look anywhere you want to look. There's no national standard. Police organizations have so many different configurations, so many different numbers of people that are assigned and doing different work. There is no, that I've ever seen, national standard of 60%. I will tell you this, that we have a PhD, a researcher on our team, on our command staff, who at our direction started looking at what would be good deployment numbers, what would make sense for our deployment. And he came up with, hey, it would be great if we could have, it looks like 60% would be about the right level for us to deploy folks. And we started on our own initiation, by the way, started deploying officers to try to make sure that 60% of anybody coming into, you know, any of the new hires are assigned to patrol, and the other percentages would go to the other bureaus. So I would say that number is not the accurate number, that we are really striving at that 60%, but that 60% is our own self-imposed goal.
This search committee memo also said, quote, SPD lacks supervisor accountability standards and capabilities. If you accept that, what would you do about it?
Well, we're always looking to improve the ability of supervisors. I can tell you from when I came on, there is so much more supervision now, and certainly after the consent decree, their supervisors are monitoring a whole lot more work that their officers are doing. They're spending a lot more time engaging. We have technology in place that we can look. I can right now look and see how many times people responded to calls, who responded to calls, when the shifts are getting the most calls, where in the city people are deployed to, and what kind of call load they have. We have so much technology that helps inform us about how to do things that we didn't even have even 5 years ago. So with our data analytics platform and our ability to use our dashboards. And so I would say supervisors are a lot more engaged and have a lot more information at their fingertips. And I would also counter that with, we also need to continue. I mean, it's not like we just stop there. We're always looking for ways to get better supervision. But we have come such a long way.
Finally, Chief Best, we have this backdrop, as we mentioned, of Seattle years ago having been found to be using excessive force in the police department, evidence of biased policing. You said we've come a long way since then. Will you make the case to KUOW listeners now about why you're the best person to continue that work and do other work going forward?
Well, I mentioned it before, but when we started this process, the consent decree process, and Chief O'Toole, who is, again, a nationally known expert, internationally known expert, when she came in, she handpicked me to be the number two person working on the day-to-day operations to get the Seattle Police Department through the initial consent decree and reform process. It is an iterative process. It continues. We've come such a long way. Use of force use is way down, under 1% for some of the, under 2%, that is, for some of the major calls that we're dealing with. So I would say we've come a long way. I'm not saying we're there, but we've come a long way. We are on a great trajectory moving forward. We're in our sustainment period right now, and the word of the day is going to be embedding and making sure that the culture of the police department, that the culture is continuously changing with innovation moving forward. And that is where we are.
That's interim police chief, candidate for police chief in the city of Seattle, Carmen Best. Thank you for coming again.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And next, I'm going to speak to the other two finalists for the job of Seattle police chief, Eddie Frizzell and Eli Reyes. So stay tuned. Again, for the first half of this hour on the record, we're talking to the final three candidates for Seattle Chief of Police. Mayor Jenny Durkin's expected to make her choice later this month. You just heard from interim police chief Carmen Best, and our next candidate is Minneapolis Police Inspector Eddie Frizzell. He's spent 30 years in the military. He's currently a colonel, and I began our conversation by asking him to describe himself. Tell us his story.
Consider myself a leader, first and foremost. My integrity and honor is something that's been drilled into me not only from my military service as a officer, but by my parents. They instilled a work ethic in me that is unbending. I do the right things for the right reason. And what rings in my head once an hour every day is that, sir, all you have is your word. So when you say you're going to do something, then do it. And I've presented a lot of credentials to the process that ground me, because I wasn't always an academician growing up, but I've developed a love for education. I currently hold a couple of master's degrees, including a master's in strategic studies from the United States Army War College, as well as an FBI National Academy grad, Senior Management Institute of Police. So I'm well-rounded academically, and with that work ethic that my parents instilled in me and just my world experiences sets me up to help lead a department in a very vibrant and dynamic city that Seattle is today.
There have been some stories, anecdotal stories, conflicting stories about officers leaving the SPD or wanting to leave. And some people say the Seattle City Council's liberal rhetoric is to blame. I wonder, what sense have you gotten of morale on the force in Seattle?
Well, after 25 years in law enforcement, policing has a very common core, and that's individuals get into this job not for the prestige, not for the money, but they get into it to protect and serve. And then that runs deep, because you're certainly never going to get rich doing this job. So I look at any report that a person leaves because they feel that they may not be in optimal conditions. It kind of goes adverse to the way I think, for the simple fact that every 911 call you go to is going to be something that you probably didn't predict, something that you've probably trained for, but some falls, frankly, into that you can't make this stuff up. So to think that your average officer would walk away just because of the perception or what somebody says about them, that's a stretch for me personally.
And in that you don't really believe it's a big problem, or it's a stretch that you're being critical of an officer who would feel that way?
I mean that for the simple fact that attrition right now, most of the departments are graying out. And that simply means that people are moving on.
Getting older.
Older, going into retirement. And I would look at that as an opportunity to recruit back from the communities and get their best and brightest and insert them into key positions on the police department moving forward, so we can all meet the mayor's vision as well as the consent decree's reforms mandates.
While at the Minneapolis Police Department, you filed a lawsuit against a prior police chief. The lawsuit was related to your demotion at the police department. What happened there?
Well, I would simply say that I fought for my honor. I fought for a right to get a veterans preference hearing that I felt I was deserving of after at least 30 years in the military. And I can kind of say with absolute confidence, I currently hold a top security clearance that's something that's reviewed every 5 years. I've been vetted by the FBI National Academy, and I've been vetted through the United States Army War College. And at the end of the day, I'm the last one standing of that entire situation.
Why did you think you didn't get that veteran recognition?
There was a variety of reasons they cited, one of which seemed to be based on a city ordinance from 1962, and specifically named the deputy chief of patrol as not having the ability to have a veteran's preference. And individuals seemed to side with that.
A judge had ruled that you weren't completely honest when you told a reporter you didn't know why you were demoted. And there were documents showing several colleagues expressing concerns about your responsiveness or your trustworthiness. What do you want to say about that?
All manufactured after the fact.
Any idea why people would do that?
Well, again, I have a 25-year track record. I've, again, been in the military for 30 years. I've been vetted by top organizations and entities in the United States government, to include two combat tours. And at the end of all that, again, I am the last one standing of those individuals that would have made those statements.
We in Seattle have, as you well know, dealt with the federal government finding the department guilty of using excessive force, some evidence of biased policing. What are some... Are there any new ways that haven't been tried yet let me put it this way. How would you continue the reforms that Seattle has made?
Well, I have a considerable amount of experience, specifically through the Minneapolis Police Department, the Mediation Compliance Agreement, where as a sergeant, I was in charge of the operational identification of those reform efforts, pulling together stakeholders and community leaders in order to come up with a consensus on what those things looked like in regards to initially being talked about, working groups putting together their think tanks and receiving all the different input from the, we called them the Unity Community Team, and then coming to consensus after several months of very heated discussion across the board. But I found then that I have a very good skill as a consensus builder, in which we were able to turn nearly 169 reform mandated action items green, which simply means that we had consensus across the board with everyone that sat at that table, and we too were able to walk out the other side. Now, what's that led into specifically with my department is implicit bias training. We have procedural justice training, reviews of our use of force continuum, an implementation of the crisis intervention training. Those types of things that are very important to 21st century policing, we're doing now. And I've been on the cutting front of that, and I continue to move forward with that as the chief of the Seattle Police Department.
One issue that reaches a lot of our listeners and, of course, gets people's attention is an officer-involved fatality. What are some ways that are not already being tried in Seattle that could lead to fewer of those officer-involved fatalities?
Well, I'm not a clairvoyant on that, so I can't necessarily predict a particular instance because, as I stated earlier, when you're calling 911, you're having a pretty rough day. You're not calling to say hi. And those officers, they do not know what they're walking into. So it goes back to training. It goes back to individuals understanding exactly the parameters in which they're supposed to operate in those types of situations. And through that training, they develop muscle memory, which enables them to react to those very, very tragic instances where there's a loss of life. But first and foremost, officers have to have it instilled in them, that preservation for life. And once you have that, again, you're faced with all these different scenarios that you can react in the best of ability, but most ably be able to articulate the why.
I've been talking with Eddie Frizzell. Really appreciate your coming in and talking with us. Welcome to Seattle.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Minneapolis Police Inspector Eddie Frizzell is one of the three finalists for the Seattle Chief of Police job, along with Eli Reyes and Interim Chief Carmen Best. And coming up, we're going to speak with the last finalist in the group, Eli Reyes. The first half of this hour on the record, we're talking with the final three candidates for Seattle Chief of Police. Mayor Jenny Durkan expected to make a choice later this month. You just heard from the interim Seattle Police Chief, Carmen Best, and then Minneapolis Police Inspector Eddie Frizzell. And our final and the third candidate, Eli Reyes, is currently the Assistant Chief of Police with the Austin Police Department, Austin, Texas. Before that, he spent 6 years in the Army working in military police patrol operations and military intelligence. We began our conversation by comparing Seattle to his current city, Austin.
You know, I think that Austin and Seattle are very similar cities, although Austin's a little bit larger, you know, about 250,000 more people, and the size of the department is about 500 more officers than Seattle Police Department. I think that a lot of the challenges that we have in Austin are similar to the ones that are being faced here in Seattle. And that's one of the things that piqued my interest when the posting came open is that you know, the affordability issues, the homelessness, the gentrification, a lot of those same issues that Seattle's facing now, we're facing in Austin.
Why is that important to a police chief, affordability and gentrification?
I think that that plays a big role into building trust in the community. And then also, when it comes to policing the community, you have to understand that you're going to have a variance of different cultures and communities within the same area and the same region, because you have the old and the new living together side by side. And so I think that's an important factor to take into consideration.
How do you take that into consideration as a police chief? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, it's really about education, especially when you have the new coming in, educating them on the historical aspects of the city.
A new police officer?
A new police officer, yes. Making sure that they understand the historical perspective of the city. You know, one of the things that we did in Austin is we brought in the Undoing Racism training for all of the executive staff, in which we took this class with the community members so that we could be in the room together to talk about the historical aspects of institutional racism and specifically how it relates to the city of Austin. Because if you have a good understanding of the city in which you're policing, it can give you some good insight on as to why certain people feel marginalized.
And this has been an important issue for you. The Austin Police Department came under investigation by the Justice Department for allegations of racially tinged excessive force. Justice Department closed its investigation after the police department implemented their recommendations. How did the police, and this has been an issue in Seattle with evidence of a biased policing, how did the Austin Police Department change over that time?
Yeah, so that was, luckily we did not come under consent decree, but
right.
During that time, the DOJ did make 165 recommendations for the police department, and we implemented those recommendations. And a lot of that was under the leadership of Art Acevedo and changing the culture of the department to understand the importance of building trust in the community, being out in the community, building those relationships, and then changing our policies to reflect, you know, what the DOJ was telling us that best practices were, and then ensuring that not only did we have the policies in place, but they were actually being practiced on the street as well.
Do you see important differences in Seattle from Austin, or does it basically look, is it the same approach to you?
I think, you know, for the most part, it's the same approach. It's ensuring that the officers that are on the street, you know, the officers on the street are the ones that have the most interaction with the public. And the supervisors on the street really set the tone for how their officers are going to behave in the work that they're doing. And so we have to make sure that we set the expectations that our officers are going to perform up to a certain level. And part of that includes engaging the community and building relationships and helping to establish that trust and legitimacy. Because if we can have that relationship with the community, then we're going to be safer, because the community is going to trust us, which means they're going to report crime, they're going to cooperate with investigations, and at the end of the day, that's going to help all of us be safer.
Well, as you probably heard, Eli, there have been some conflicting stories about officers leaving Seattle Police Department, some of them saying that the city council's liberal rhetoric, like an anti-cop atmosphere, is to blame. What is your take on that?
You know, I think there's a lot of factors that come into play when you talk about people leaving organizations and police departments. I think one of the factors is the fact that they haven't had a police contract in several years. So I think that plays into a factor. You know, in Austin, we don't have a police contract right now, and we see the same issue that other agencies are trying to recruit from our department because it is a good department. And so I think some of the surrounding agencies are taking advantage of that situation. They're offering bonuses to officers to come over as the lateral transfer. And without a contract in place, sometimes officers see that as an opportunity to move to another department and get a bonus, and they can go work somewhere else. So I think that once we get a contract in place, that might change the landscape.
What would you do with the contract process that hasn't been done?
Well, I think that from my understanding, they're getting close. But I do think it's important to make sure that the chief of police weighs in on what he would like to see included in that contract. And having the ability to work with the union to come to bring that to a closure, I think is going to be beneficial for everyone.
Do you know ways that Seattle could reduce the number of officer-involved fatalities?
You know, I think that there's a lot of training opportunities now that have come up in the last several years when it comes to de-escalation. You know, the Police Executive Research Forum just put out a manual and some training about de-escalation, integrating communications and tactics. When it talked about utilizing force under circumstances that don't involve a firearm. And so I think that educating the officers on de-escalation, making sure that they understand how they can use time and distance to their benefit, making sure that they have the proper mental health training in place, because mental health is a real crisis in this country, in this community, as well as many others. And a lot of times officers are responding to people in crisis, and they need to have the tools and the ability to know how to handle those situations.
One of the other candidates for the Seattle Police Chief job is also an outsider from Minneapolis, but there's also the interim police chief, Carmen Best, who's been doing the job and has been at SPD for a long time. What case would you make that Seattle ought to bring in somebody else?
You know, I think that the mayor has a very tough decision to make when she's making a selection who's going to be the police chief. And at the end of the day, the mayor has to make her choice based on who she believes can put the Seattle Police Department in a position to where, one, they're going to maintain compliance with the consent decree for the next 18 months to be able to get out from under that consent decree. And two, to also continue on those reforms and foster a change of culture within the organization so that those changes are actually embedded and moving forward. It just becomes common practice.
Eli Reyes, is there anything that I haven't asked you, but you want to tell KUOW listeners about the job of running the Seattle Police Department?
You know, I'm excited about the opportunity to be the police chief in Seattle. And I know that there are a lot of challenges that this city and the department are facing. And I think that I have both the experience and the ability to face those challenges, to build trust in the community, and to have the trust of the officers, too. And so I look forward to it, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Eli, thank you.
Yep.
Eli Reyes, Assistant Chief of Police with the Austin, Texas Police Department. He's one of three finalists for Seattle Chief of Police, along with Eddie Frizzell and Interim Chief Carmen Best. And you can hear all of our interviews with the candidates at our website, KUOW.org. Coming up, white fragility, white privilege, white guilt. We're going to talk race and you and me. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. You know we're live tweeting the show on Twitter. Is at KUOW is the handle. I like it when you send me an email about something that you hear on this show. I try to answer your questions. Sometimes I ask you questions. One of the occasional recurring themes in my inbox is comments like this one from a KUOW listener. Quote, "As a white American, I've become acclimated over the past 50 years to having every problem on earth, especially those which disproportionately affect non-whites, blamed on me." End of quote. Are racial justice advocates blaming everything on white people? Here to answer that and other questions and comments about race is a white person and a mixed-race person. They both know a lot about whiteness and race. They study it and they live it. Robin DiAngelo lives in Seattle, has a PhD in multicultural education from the University of Washington, and she wrote the book White Fragility. You coined the phrase, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah. And Keanu Wheeler is part of the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative, a citywide effort to end institutionalized racism and race-based disparities in city government, right?
Yes. And I also have a consulting firm, Racial Equity Consultants, and I'm really often when I talk about race, it's in that capacity.
Racial Equity Consultants, a consulting firm. Thanks to both of you for being here. So that listener I quoted feels personally blamed for, quote, every problem on earth, especially those which disproportionately affect non-whites. Robin, would you call, is that an example of white fragility, the name of your book?
Yes, in the sense of asking how it functions, right? So does that way of looking at it open this person up, engender any kind of reflection at all? It's so larger than life. You know, realistically, are we blamed for every problem in the world? Now, do you feel blamed for racial disparity? I can engage with that piece of the claim.
Do you blame all people for racial disparity?
I don't blame all people. I do believe that it is a system that whites control and wield and benefit from. And while I didn't set it up, I have responsibility for my part in it. And I do play a part in it, regardless of my conscious awareness or intentions. We all play a part in the system that we're living in.
Keanu, what's your take on white people feeling blamed?
Oh, wow. As a person of color, I'm constantly watching the things that I say simply because folks respond in that way. But I would say that when we talk about conversations of race, we often talk about between two people. We talk about interpersonal racism. It's something that we're familiar with. We know when people say a racial slur or when they have issues with people because of their race. But we don't often talk about the institutional or the structural impacts of race and racism. And when we have conversations about race, we also don't talk about both sides of the coin. Generally, when white folks talk about race and racism, it only happens because people of color, black and brown people, have walked into a room, and then race becomes a thing. And what I love about Robin's book is it really names that there's this place in which white folks need to begin having conversations about what does it mean to be white in conversations of race. And
what do you mean when you say that we're too for both of you, that we're you're saying we're too fragile, white people are too fragile or too ignorant to have that conversation?
Well, what I would say is that we are socialized to be functionally illiterate on this topic, right? What you have to work really hard as a white person in this society to get good information about how racism works. You can get through graduate school without ever discussing racism. You can be seen as qualified to lead a group of people with no ability to engage deeply. And so without a really sustained study, struggle, focus, relationship building, mistake making, we tend to have really superficial understandings.
Okay. Kiana, this is another email that, again, this I chose some that I think are pretty typical from the ones I've saved. This listener says, I do not like the increasing acceptance of the whole white privilege mantra. To me, the privilege clearly belongs to non-whites in current discourse. To be a non-white is to claim instantaneous victimhood, which helps the supposed victim aggrandize their accomplishments and minimize their failures. It's not good for them. It's not good for me. That's not good for the country. What would you like to say to that listener and people who agree with that?
So assuming that that person's white, correct?
I don't know. No.
It sounds a bit about someone who's never actually experienced oppression on an ongoing daily basis. What comes up for me is that for the first time maybe in their life, they're not the center of the world, the center of being and doing and thinking as the right way. It is almost this way in which at this point in time, white folks are having to legitimize their existence as the standard, as the norm, and for the first time are being asked to do that. And when that comes up with very little awareness or analysis of how racism and oppression functions, I call it we go to our corners, so in like in a boxing ring. So they go to their corner and start addressing race from a place that they are very unfamiliar with.
And actually, I would say that is a classic example of white fragility in the sense of white people are really fragile in that we're so rarely outside of our comfort zone. And Kiana really beautifully articulated, right? Like, we are being held to answer to a bit, why we continually get racial inequality in all our outcomes by every measure, even though individually most white people would say, I have nothing to do with this system, right? Our outcomes are not actually getting better. But we're so rarely asked to think critically about race. We all have opinions, but really think critically that it throws us off what I think of as our racial equilibrium, and we get really defensive. I mean, honestly, I found that email a little bit mean-spirited, certainly not remotely sensitive to the impact that would have on a person of color who experiences racism day in and day out. And so white fragility is a really effective way to repel the challenge to our positions and our identities and kind of regain our racial equilibrium, which is basically dominance and control. And it doesn't have to be intentional. That is how it functions. It prevents any further engagement. It closes the conversation while at the same time making white people the victims.
So you're saying it doesn't have to be intentional, but you're also calling the email mean-spirited. I mean, do you have empathy for white people who feel defensive or fragile and don't know as much as you do about racial dynamics?
It's challenging to feel if without seeing some humility, some willingness to acknowledge, maybe there's something here I don't see. Could I at least grapple with it? Could I try it on? Could I listen? Do I have any curiosity? Or am I just going to rehearse the worldview I already hold and insist on that worldview and push away any alternative worldview?
Well, to be fair, maybe emailing me is a way of grappling with it. They could just keep their thoughts to themselves, but I imagine the listeners and emailers struggling with this along with us.
There was I heard a lot of certitude and a lot of definitive kind of rejection of any question at all that white people benefit from being white in this country. That is how I heard that. I don't know how you heard that, Kiana, as a woman of color.
Yeah, as a woman of color, how I heard it is how I've heard it my entire life. I think about from the time I was 5 years old on up, about you're playing the race card, or it's not about race. When I look at whiteness as a construct and white folks in whiteness, I think about the ways in which everything is normalized to uphold and encourage the viewpoint of whiteness as the right way.
Everything is encourages the white as right?
So, I mean, if I'm talking about from the time that I was young and up until now as a grown woman, every bit about how I wear my hair has been dominated by what the standards of beauty are for whiteness. When I go grocery shopping, you know, everything that I need is down the ethnic aisle. I have asked my grocery store to make the other aisles white aisles, and they don't find that funny. Mm. but it's like the way in which I experience the world is that I am always other. I'm never the center. I'm never the point. I'm never the purpose. My undergrad is in literature. And the first time we read an author that was a black author, I remember my classmates talking about how this doesn't resonate with them. And I don't know why I have to do this. And I'm like, look, I've been not resonating with all of the dead white authors that I've been reading this whole time. And even the literary canon about what is expected to be truth and to be upheld centers around white maleness.
Yeah, white maleness, by the way, it's not when you say white culture, that's not just a blank slate, right? There's maleness and heteronormativeness, right? And mm-hmm. patriarchy and all that is together. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I would ask that. You know, the person who emailed, have you actually listened to the voices of people of color? Because first, I would just fundamentally disagree that those voices are privileged over white voices. Look at our government, look at our institutions, look at our film directors. Look, I mean, every area in which information is disseminated is controlled by white people. If you had listened to those voices, I think the tone of that email would be different, right? I think you're speaking about patriarchy in terms of, you know, is it everybody white? What I would say is that being a white woman, a cisgender white woman, does change somewhat my experience of whiteness because that's a really powerful intersection. But white women actually aren't inherently any more supportive to people of color than white men are. In fact, when we don't stand behind them or beside them, I think the hurt can even be deeper because we do have a potential way in through our understanding of sexism. But so often we use that as a way out, right? Oh, it's the universal sisterhood and we all experience oppression. And there's no more a universal woman's experience than there is a universal human experience in the physical world, in the here and now, in a society that's deeply separate and unequal by race.
So let's go through some other listener, questions or reactions. Here's a listener who says, quote, I feel neither guilt nor any shame being white, and I am not going to ever allow anyone embittered and pissy to force me into feeling that way. So some of that language aside, Kiana, are you saying white people should feel guilty? Do you want white people to feel guilty? This is it's a theme in my emails.
I do not. I actually am really grateful anytime I hear white folks say that I don't feel guilty and I don't feel shame, regardless if they're on the side of I believe that racism is a problem or on the side of not, because I can't actually use guilt and shame. I can't use you. I can't. What I need as a person who is pushing against the system of racism is I need people to be in practice with me, and guilt and shame hold us from doing the work that we need to. I call on my white colleagues and my white friends when I need them to speak truth to whiteness, and guilt and shame is going to inhibit them from doing that.
Okay.
And I really need their help.
Yeah. Listeners, let the record reflect, you are not being told to feel guilty.
Oh, please.
I just asked. The answer was no. How about...
Well, I think anyone who hangs out with me should be really clear. I am not racked with guilt.
Yeah.
I feel responsible for my role in this system, and I'm really clear that inaction is a form of action, right? The default of our society is the reproduction of racial inequality. I mean, that's what it does. Every measure, every institution, we keep reproducing racial inequality. And I play a part. What's on me is to figure out what is that part and to do something different. So responsibility and guilt are really, really different.
Right.
That's a good point. Right. I just want to note, I was stuck with the last thing I said, which was I need white folks in order to do this work. I need white folks in white spaces. One of the biggest myths is that black and brown folks want what white folks have, and we actually just want to be free from white folks' constraint, from the constraints of whiteness. And so when I'm saying I need white folks, I need white folks to be in conversation with other white folks, which is one of the reasons why I appreciate the book, naming that it is for white people. I actually am happy to be my own person in my own space and not need from white folks in that way.
One more listener reaction before we take a break and come right back. I feel this quote from an email, quote, I feel no privilege being white. I am dirt poor. I am indigent on Medicaid. It's all relative. Does white privilege mean there are not poor white people? Poor white people have white privilege.
I think what people hear when they hear white privilege, one is that you're going to feel this privilege, right? And I think it's so taken for granted. It's like the absence of feeling it or noticing it. But we're not saying you haven't faced barriers or struggled. What we're saying is you have not faced this barrier, and it does help you navigate the barriers that you do face. I don't know who could deny that to be poor and white in this country would be different than being poor and black, because black people who are poor are also dealing with that added layer of racism. And I grew up in poverty, and I would direct anyone, any other white person, to my essay, My Class Didn't Trump My Race, Using Oppression to Face Privilege. I've had a deep sense of shame as a child. It could go on and on. I didn't go to college until I was in my 30s. I always knew I was white. I always knew on some level we weren't at the total bottom, and that we were better than other people because we were white.
Mm-hmm. I would just have to add that that's probably one of the, if I can be frank, most irritating phrases that I hear when I do my work. And the reason why I say that is there's this space where we have to actually analyze what the currency of whiteness is. And it's not based on the only whiteness. Like, there are other pieces that add to it, like Robin was talking about class, but there's a currency that whiteness has. And when folks are like, yeah, I could throw my whiteness away, I'm like, let's talk about how much it's worth socially, because I could use some of that movement. it's one of the places I don't go with people. I call on my white friends to say, talk to these folks, because I don't need to, I'm not asking you to understand what it's like to be a person of color. I'm asking you to understand what it's like to be white.
Okay. Note to listeners, number one, white people, they're not saying white people should feel guilty. Number two, they are not saying that white privilege means all white people have it easy. By the way, we're talking with the author of White Fragility, this is Robin DiAngelo, and with the consulting firm Racial Equity Consultants, and working with the City of Seattle as well, Kiana Wheeler. Let's skip taking a break. I just want to keep going through these listener what listeners want to say to you, to racial justice advocates. This is an email I got. Quote, I'm a boomer white female who lived in Asia for a decade or so. I saw the amazing culture and great ideas and kindness of the people there. Also, I heard that white people have an odor. Asian people wanted to touch my hair. My friend said they wanted to touch her nose. An Asian man showed me how he wiped his hand on his pants after shaking hands with a black man. I heard how inferior the people in neighboring Asian countries were. My point, this writer goes on, my point is that white people have no corner on the racism market. Kiana, Are you saying that only white people are racist?
I absolutely think that that is a question Robin should begin with. Absolutely.
Curiosity about difference is different than feeling oppressed because of that difference. As a white person moving through Asia, I bring with me the history of colonization, the history of being a United States citizen, and people may be curious. They may even have prejudice towards me. But I would not necessarily call that racism, right? All human beings have racial biases based on our conditioning, our socialization. When you back a group's collective bias with legal authority and institutional control, it is transformed into a far-reaching system that's no longer dependent on individuals. So in the United States, okay, readers, put your seatbelts on. In the United States, only white people, I reserve the term racist to describe our bias, because I need to distinguish the difference when it's backed by control of all the institutions. And yes, they are just as biased or prejudiced as we are, but racism I reserve for power.
Anything you want to add, Kiana?
Yeah, thanks, Robin, for taking that one, because immediately some triggered feelings came up, and part of that has a bit to do with the history as an anti-racist practice. I'm grounded in the principles of People's Institute, where we talk about that history follows people, and you don't get to be this individual being in Asia without understanding how colonization has functioned to even center whiteness globally. And so while white folks get to be individuals who travel to Asia, Asian folks in that question collectively become a body. And that is clearly part of white culture, is to be an individual. I don't hold my history. I don't hold the ways in which whiteness functions. I get to be a human being by myself, not attached to anything, and I get to globally go around and talk about collective races. And so I was just triggered in that moment. So thank you for taking that on.
Okay, so let the record reflect, you're not saying that non-white people are not bigoted or prejudiced. You're defining racism in a way that maybe some of us aren't used to defining it. Like, maybe we should just like make that really clear what we mean when we say racism.
That's one of the key challenges of having this conversation, right, is that we are taught that a racist is always an individual. You know, some people are racist and some are not. It must be conscious. You must be aware that you have bias, and you must intentionally mean to be hurtful to people. Individual, conscious, intentional. And that definition exempts virtually all white people from the system that we're actually in. And I think it's the root of all white defensiveness on this, because when we suggest that you actually are connected to this system and that you do have patterns that are racially problematic, what you hear is, I've just said you're intentionally mean to people based on race. And then, you know, let the games begin.
Let the defensiveness begin. Here's an email I got from a listener. Quote, I think stories that make people feel bad about themselves, regardless of the intent, are not successful stories, especially when they reference an entire racial group. KUOW used to be my best friend, but I now find myself wondering when the next feel guilty about being white story is going to air. And more disturbingly, I'm finding resentful racist thoughts coming into my head, which have never been there before. And I don't like those thoughts. Who wants to take that?
Yeah, you know, I would say that once I began to understand race and racism and the impacts, I lost a lot of best friends, too. And so I am not any more focused on the quantity of friends, but more the quality of friends that I have. So I appreciate KUOW. I'm a longtime listener. I appreciate you being a quality of friend for me.
Thank you.
I also want to name that... For a long, long time, and when I say long, long time, I'm talking specifically about my life, I to this day have not lived long enough to love myself as long as I hated myself. Two more years.
I'm sorry to hear that, Kiana.
That's whiteness and racism, right? Grew up in Issaquah. I was one of a few folks of color, and the rest of them happened to be my family. and I did not learn the amazingness of who I was until I left that space and began to explore what my value is and how I value myself. But one of the things that's very clear for me is that this is new for white folks. It's very, very new. And for the first time, white folks are really having to explore something that they've never had named. And the amazingness of whiteness is its invisibility. And the moment that it becomes visible is the moment that people have reactions to it. And rather than being curious, I get, you know, that this person is saying that now they're having all of these racist thoughts after having these conversations. And part of that comes from not exploring what is going on. Curiosity has lost its impact on our humanity. And the fact that folks can actually see harm that is happening to folks of color, to black and brown folks at our borders, in our jails, on our streets. The fact that they can see harm and not connect it to the humanity of people shows me that we're actually in a place where people are trying to intellectualize conversations about race rather than feel conversations about race.
We have one-ish minute left. And so I want to ask this question along the lines of that last listener who just, you know, thinks it's not working. It's making people feel bad. Do you have any concern that white resentment at cultural elites like us helped elect Donald Trump? This idea of, you know, you're doing it wrong. It's a bad tactic.
I think white resentment at black advancement helped elect Donald Trump. The white collective has always been able to be manipulated by triggering racial animus. It's a very, very old strategy. You know, look up the Southern strategy. Let me just say really quickly that this show or any other show you didn't plant racist thoughts in our minds or in the person's mind. They're there. They do drive our behavior. And as a sociologist, I'm quite comfortable generalizing about white people. Social life is patterned and predictable in observable ways. And part of being white is we never have to think about ourselves as a member of a group. But in the same way that I don't think anyone would deny that being raised a girl versus being raised a boy is a different experience, so is being raised as a white person versus a person of color.
I have 1,000 other questions. Can we do this again? Please.
Sure,
I've enjoyed this. Robin DiAngelo.
Can we get some open emails, please?
wrote the book.
You're really working us here.
I am. I was working you, so thank you for the work. White Fragility is the book, and Kiana Wheeler is with Racial Equity Consultants. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, Matt Martin, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tonight, we're taking the show to Bothell, the Week in Review live. Come see us. Our panel is Chris Vance, Joni Balter, and Nikita Oliver. We'll review the week's news on stage at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. Yes, tonight, doors open at 6. Tickets are free, but reserve your seat. Go now to kuow.org/engage. kuow.org/engage. See you tonight.